Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This time last year, California State Park officials announced the closure of 70 of the state's 278 state parks because of the budget deficit. California State Parks offer beaches, forests, deserts, mountains, and a rich living history of the land and people. The plan was to close the 70 parks by this July. A lucky few of those threatened parks have been granted temporary closure relief from some combination of assistance from nonprofits, corporations, public agencies, and individual interests. They include Mono Lake, South Yuba River, Castle Rock, Henry Coe, Petaluma Adobe, and Plumas Eureka. Advocates working to save our state parks are pushing for more collaborations like these to keep them open. So on today's Your Call, we are getting an update on our state parks. Which parks would you fight for? What are some of your favorites? Are they on the chopping block? What can we do to keep these parks open while maintaining their integrity and accessibility for all? Today we are joined by Ruth Coleman. She is director of California State Parks. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Alyssa Stansil, Vice President of Valley of the Moon Natural History Association. The Valley of the Moon in the Northern California wine country stretches between Santa Rosa and Sonoma. For the past 35 years, the association has been greeting and educating visitors at Jack London, Annadel, and Sugarloaf State Parks, all slated to close. They represent 12,500 acres. The Valley of the Moon Natural History Association has stepped in to take on operations at Jack London State Park. Today is the first day, and they're very excited about this. The association is the very first nonprofit to enter into this kind of agreement. Hi, Alyssa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Christopher Ward, Executive Director of Folk for Parks. That's a nonprofit that's dedicated to keeping the parks open, and they have traveled to over 200 state parks since 2009. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thanks
Hi.
For coming in. So, Ruth, let's get an update. 70 state parks were on the chopping block, and just about under 10 of them have been issued a reprieve for about 1 to 5 years. Give us an update. Where are we right now?
Okay, yeah. Last year we announced that there were 70 parks that we could no longer afford to operate ourselves, and we sort of put the call out to try to find partners to help run these parks. And we've had 5 public meetings that we did around the state. We sent out like 4,000 invitations. We met with about 89 different organizations that attended these public meetings. And so through that, I'm pleased to announce that actually we're up to 16 parks now have some other alternative group who we have an agreement with, similar to what Alyssa Stansil's group is doing at Jack London, although I will say each one is slightly different because each park is so unique. So we have arrangements with cities, with counties, with National Park Service, and then in some cases with nonprofits. And the Valley of the Moon, they were the first ones under new legislation that was signed by the governor in January, which is AB 42. In addition, we have about 19 parks that were currently in very active negotiations, so we're cautiously optimistic that those additional 19 will probably be able to get some kind of deal, we hope. And then we have another 21 that we've put out for request for proposal for the campground portion of the park. And so if the private sector can step up, then we could keep the campgrounds open. We would continue to provide some of the law enforcement and other kinds of services. So we're seeing whether or not the campgrounds could stay open in another 21. So that brings us to 56 parks, potentially, that we have some sort of hope for. And, you know, we're still very, very aggressively looking for partners and hoping to get that number, you know, as big as we can, get as close to 70 as we can.
And I imagine this is taking a lot of work behind the scenes. Just hearing you explain this, I'm just kind of visualizing what is going on behind the scenes to create these relationships.
It is incredibly taxing on staff, I would say. They are being so creative and flexible. Staff, you know, everybody feels so passionate about these parks. And we're getting lots of good feedback and people are coming, you know, donors that come, like you mentioned, Henry Coe, that was a donor agreement. So in some cases, we're getting a donor who will come to the table, and then that will then fund state parks to continue operating the park. So, you know, there's so many, there's like many different ways that we can save these parks. We can do them through operating agreements with nonprofits. We can do them with operating agreements with cities or counties. We can do it with operating agreements with National Park Service or other regional park districts. And then we also can do donor agreements. So there's a plethora of mechanisms that we have, and we are willing to try anything, and in some cases a blend of them as well. And so it's really, we're trying to be as creative as we possibly can to infuse some energy into all of these parks so that they don't just become sort of closed and then start to decay.
And so when we're talking about the budget, Elisa, it's $22 million this year, and we could see another $11 million chopped off the parks budget next year?
Well, I know that Ruth will speak to this, but there are service reductions going on in many, many parks that are going to plan to stay open because the budget issues are not resolved, and they were already teetering on the brink of difficult budget situations prior to this most recent cut. So the additional cuts and the lack of faith of future revenue makes it very difficult to provide all the services that everybody would so much enjoy.
Yes, Elisa's right. We are doing a lot of service reductions. The cut actually was broken into two phases, 11 and 11, so it's a total loss of $22 million. But this comes on the heels of many cuts that have happened over the past 30 years. I mean, people need to understand that the narrative of state parks has been one that used to enjoy over 90% of its budget from the general fund, if you go back to 79, 80. And today, starting this July, we'll be down to 29% of our budget from general fund. So there's been this huge decline over the years. As we no longer receive taxes to steward these resources, we're now having to generate revenues, and there's a limit to how much you can actually generate. And so we are undersourced. We estimate about $150 million a year just on maintenance.
Wow.
So we have a $1.3 billion backlog in deferred maintenance. So across the state, we run the risk of losing these cultural and natural treasures. What the crisis that's upon us now is an operations one where we can't even afford to have staff at some of these parks. And so we're trying to figure out how to move our staff around to maximize public access and minimize pain. And yet there's still so much of it. And so
exactly,
it is really a challenge.
Yes, at the three state parks where we have been for 35 years, there used to be five rangers, sometimes seven, to make a circuit through all those parks, and it was wonderful. And that we're talking about in the 80s. And at this point, there is really like one ranger that's shared between five and seven parks, and this is not possible to do a fabulous job. Or it's very stressful on the particular individual who's spending an awfully lot of time driving, and it's just not functional at this point. So, you know, we welcome the opportunity to step in and assist and do interim operations.
And how were you able to do that? We're talking about the Valley of the Moon Natural History Association stepping in to take on operations at Jack London State Park, and today is your first official day.
I have to say, it's really just like Christopher sitting here beside me. It's partnership, partnership, partnership. California State Parks Foundation, the department, California State Parks themselves, and the Parks Alliance of Sonoma County were key. But then there's also wonderful creative partnerships we have, like with Transcendence Theater Group and others like Folk for Park, that makes it possible for us to use every possible idea and combine them in a really unique way. So at Jack London, I just want to briefly say we have 1,400 acres, but we have a lot of historic buildings, which includes a lot of artifacts, and we also have $3 million in deferred maintenance. So we have a huge amount of money that we need to raise to solve some of these problems that are ongoing, and then we have our revenue that we need to generate in order to keep the park open and thriving. So the Parks Alliance was formed in Sonoma County, and it's a group of partners from every kind of nonprofit and funded initially by the Sonoma Land Trust. By having these different people come together and pitch in, we have other nonprofits that are doing some of the work for us. Sonoma Ecology Center doing the back, the natural resource management. We have Sonoma County Trails Council doing the trails. We have partnership with Annadale that will be coming up that's going to provide ranger call-outs for us once they're online. So, you know, that's how we can do it. We are not doing it. We all are doing it.
And Christopher, your group, Folk for Parks, has been traveling to over 200 state parks since 2009. And in the last year, you've been raising awareness about this. What has that experience been like to you? When you talk to people, what do they tell you about the importance of state parks? And what's the reaction to the announcement that 70 parks might close in July?
Sure. And, you know, you had said at the beginning of this broadcast, you know, trying to figure out how to say preserve the integrity of California parks. And I think what's important to talk about is exactly that, what's integral about parks. And, you know, what people talk about is the loss of public access. And we take that for granted in America, especially in California. But this wasn't always the case, that natural spaces were preserved for the public. In fact, it's a very Californian idea. Frederick Olmsted, John Muir, others, more than 100 years ago, were the ones who said, no, not only are we going to preserve these public spaces, but we're going to spend considerable amounts of money to invest in infrastructure, all the things we're not paying for now. And these are the things that I see in park after park around the state. Pio Pico, one of the smallest state parks, is a small adobe in the middle of Encino, I believe.
Whittier,
thank you. Carolyn Schuff is nobly working to save that state park. And contrast that with Mono Lake, which is the size of two San Franciscos. Mm. They all have considerably different problems. But in some ways, they all share the same notion of sharing rangers, depending on volunteers, looking for ways to partner with nonprofit organizations. There are already incredibly good examples. Mono Lake Committee, Friends of Pio Pico State Park, Friends of Santa Susana State Park, which was founded last November, as well as Valley of the Moon, as well as a bunch of new organizations in Sonoma.
So you're familiar with the community groups that are working really hard to keep these parks open. How, for example, did the group keep Mono Lake open?
Well, so the Mono Lake Committee has been working for many years, not only to keep the park open, but Mono Lake is actually shared, it is a state park itself, but also, and Ruth, you can speak more specifically to this, but I believe it's also governed by state and federal lands. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the Forest Service has a presence.
Yeah, Forest Service. And, but Mono Lake also has the double duty of also trying to work to make sure the lake isn't drained any more than it is. And it has a considerable amount of attention focused on water rights management and working with the City of Los Angeles and others to make sure that this lake is preserved beyond just the preservation of the park itself. And they do an incredibly good job as an organization in a four or five people in a room not much larger than this, working to make this all happen.
So I guess the main question here is, how do we keep these parks open while maintaining their integrity and accessibility for all? And it sounds like there are just so many different groups coming together, partnerships, nonprofits, corporations, individuals. And Elisa, what about that main question?
Well, I think one of the things that's really cool is that we got the announcement last May, and it seemed, and we had all this time to, you know, cobble something together. And in fact, as we worked on it, the more we started to work on it, the more we realized that this approach that we were doing by ourselves in Sonoma County could be used as a model for other places. The idea of integrity and the shared values, which are sort of the two combination things that you really want to preserve, and access, is sort of integral to the people that are already the community groups that are working in the park. So if you have volunteers already in place and they have this knowledge, it's a fabulous resource. And in some cases, like Annadale, there wasn't really a community group that was supporting it fully. And it really required a call to come out. And they have now generated Friends of Annadale, working with the Parks Alliance. So you see this grassroots desire and people coming forward who are the constituents who really benefit or could benefit if they don't even know about it yet. So the beauty is we had this time, even though at the time it seemed like, well, you know, kind of either too much time or what's the, you know, there was a little bit of concern and fear. And yet this very factor of time has worked in our favor. And I want to thank the department for giving us this much time.
And that is Elisa Stansil, Vice President of Valley of the Moon Natural History Association. They stepped in to take on operations at Jack London State Park in Sonoma County, and today is their first full day in operation. The association is the first nonprofit to enter into this kind of agreement. We're also joined by Ruth Coleman, Director of California State Parks, and Christopher Ward, Executive Director of Folk for Parks. They're dedicated to keeping the parks open. And we'd love to hear from you. Are parks in your area slated to be closed? Are community groups stepping in to come up with these kinds of partnerships to try to keep them open? Is one of your favorite parks on the chopping block? What do you think we need to do to keep them open while maintaining their integrity? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ernest Chung, calling in with Friends of China Camp in San Rafael. Hi, Ernest. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rose.
So I understand you're trying to save China Camp. And how's that going?
It's actually going quite well. We started much later than Jack London, so we're not quite as far along. We are a community-based grassroots nonprofit organization. But we have been getting a tremendous amount of community support in helping to save the park and keeping it from closure.
And so what is the process like? Are you asking people to donate money? What does that look like in case others live near parks that are slated to close and they want to get involved and do this?
There's been a number of different approaches that we have been using. One, of course, is that we need people to know that we're here to provide a focus for the community to save the park. And we are also trying to gain other community groups and users of the park to support us in carrying out our work. We have been raising a lot of money because China Camp State Park is a rather expensive park to operate. And then lastly, we are also working with state parks to go through the proposal process to become an operator of China Camp.
Yes, and that proposal process, as Ernest and myself both know, is really rigorous in a lot of ways because you have to demonstrate that you have the knowledge and the ability and the backup to have a secure, positive result. And some of it is just made up. You have some of the numbers that have to do with how much it might cost to operate a park are a little bit made up because this district never kept track of each individual park. And also the amount of money you might make in revenue, as Ernest knows, is not really accurate if you never have anyone stationed in a position to receive the revenue. It's unfortunate, but many people don't pay. So in the case of saving these parks, some of the issues have to do with revenue collection and also business savvy. So you need to build your board, and as I'm sure Ernest is doing and we did, to get the right savvy in place. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Ernest, and good luck with saving China Camp. Can you talk also, before we get back to calls, about AB 42, which is the legislation permitting nonprofits to operate state parks? I'm assuming this was a very important piece of legislation.
Are you talking to Ernest?
Elisa.
Okay. Well, we're really thrilled that Jared Huffman brought this legislation forward and that it passed. Actually, we were really, really pleased to work with Jared and his staff. And I just want to say that the notion of bringing it forward made it so much easier for us to get through the gnarly process of getting a contract. And even the language in it was really well crafted so that it gave us some direction. So it does sundown in 2019. It makes it possible for 20 standalone nonprofits to operate a single park. But we have, as an example, our group is a combination of nonprofits, so it's really not taking up one of those 20 spots, technically. I'm sure that Christopher has some stuff to say about it.
Oh, well, I mean, the thing about AB 42 that's really exciting is with California State Parks, the things that we need to do need to be different than the things we've done before. And, you know, the word that comes to mind is entrepreneurial. California is the state of entrepreneurs, and this bill allows people to step in and think creatively in ways that they weren't able to do before. In the same way, I mean, I see across the state people trying to drive awareness using social media, using creative outlets, using video, trying to reach new audiences and try and get as many people to know about these things as possible. And these nonprofits now are enabled and empowered to step in and do the types of things that cost the state a whole lot of money. And that's really exciting to see not only that this one bill comes, you know, out, but when push comes to shove and there's a budget crisis, that the government's figuring out ways to let the people who know how to solve these problems, you know, empower them.
Is this sustainable? Are you going to be able to do this in the next 5 years?
Absolutely. Our pro forma shows a fabulous continuing increase in revenue throughout the next 5 years. Our biggest challenge is to meet the other $3 million of deferred maintenance, as well as have a successful operation in general day to day. We are using the general plan that our park happens to have, which in the park lingo, everybody knows what that is, but in the world at large, it just means a study that was done at your park that it takes in every comprehensive aspect and talks about what the future could look like. And most of the things that we're trying to do are in the general plan that the state was dreaming of in 1986. So we have a template. But in addition to that, the fact that we have raised our fees by $2 per car, per vehicle. We have someone in the kiosk every hour of operation. We take credit cards, which wasn't in place. We are actually also charging for the jewel and the crown in our park to enter the cottage and stone dining room, so that those two really amazing buildings can be open to the public all day, every day that we're open.
So how much are we talking?
Well, right now we have an operating budget of about $479,000. $227,000 is anticipated to come in from revenues, but we are also still honoring all the state park passes. So there's a little bit of a squishy unknown number there, but that's just the facts. In entrepreneurship, which, you know, we have three or four people, including myself, on the board that are, you know, that your numbers are never perfect. You are going to not know as many things as you know, and that there's going to be some good things and some bad things that you don't know.
And so now to get into Jack London, how much does it cost?
That's it.
$2.
Oh, no, to get into.
To get in.
Oh, okay. It's $10 per vehicle. It's a vehicle, a day use fee, and you have 1,400 acres, 26 miles of connecting trails, and a lot of locals who love to come there. So they can have now, for the first time, an annual pass, which will be $49, and that will give them access all around. And if you were a visitor from Russia, France, Brazil, like we have so many of them, we have over 70,000 visitors a year, then if you buy anything at the House of Happy Walls, which is on one side of the park, you can get into the cottage free on the other side of the park. So we're trying to cross promote the two sides of the park, because a lot of people don't even know there's two sides, because there's been so long since there's been a lot of staff there.
So are we seeing, Ruth, changes in admission? Right before, we have about 30 seconds before we go to break, will we start to see parks charge more to get in?
Yes, I mean, we're charging more in a number of our beach campsites now, and we're also changing our annual pass. It's a statewide annual pass. And so I think that you're going to be seeing a lot more, in essence, sort of business model, entrepreneurship. Even we're doing that more in our parks that are not on the closure list. Again, it comes back to that narrative. Taxpayers used to be willing to pay for over 90% of the parks budget to be stewards, and so that's what staff did. Mm. They stewarded it, and they did it really well, and then they were really, really cheap and available to everyone. You fast forward 30 years, we have a new paradigm that happened really without any public debate, that taxpayers are no longer willing to pay for their parks in the way they used to.
Well,
so now you're down to less than a third. You got to earn it yourself.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's the main thing here, is that the taxpayers. So we're talking to taxpayers. Are you willing to pay for your state parks? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco every week. 10,000 listeners all over the Bay Area listen to KALW, but not at 91.7. but via our online streams at kalw.org. So if you travel outside the Bay Area, or if there are times when you encounter the limits of our signal, the online stream is a great way to stay connected to your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show, yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be joined by Rory O'Connor, journalist and author of the new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. We'll also discuss coverage of the Arab Spring with journalist Reese Ehrlich, who is just back from Tunisia. And then on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the impact of growing student debt. An entire generation is being sunk in to thousands of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars of debt. So what does this mean for the future of education and the economy? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what it will take to keep our state parks open. You probably remember that this time last year, California state park officials announced the closure of 70 of the state's 278 state parks because of the state's budget, or you could say revenue deficit. And there was outrage up and down the state. So a lot of community groups got together, put their heads together and said, what can we do to save our parks? And now we've got about 16 parks that have been issued a reprieve. They include Annandale State Park, Castle Rock State Park, Henry Coe, Petaluma Adobe, Tomales Bay, and Jack London. So if you are, if one of your favorite parks is on the chopping block, we'd love to hear from you. If you're involved in these efforts to save state parks, we'd love to hear from you. And then at the end of the day, this is really about taxpayers. As Ruth Coleman, director of California State Parks, just said, taxpayers used to pay for state parks. This is what taxpayers wanted to do, and things have really shifted over the last 30 years. So what are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. We actually have full lines. We'll have one open in just a couple minutes. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Elisa Stansil, vice president of Valley of the Moon Natural History Association. They stepped in to take on operations at Jack London State Park in Sonoma County. Today is their first day of full operations. Christopher Ward is executive director of Folk for Parks, a nonprofit dedicated to keeping the parks open. And we have a number of callers on the line, so let's go through a few and then we'll get comments from our guests. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Off my speaker. Well, I was wondering about why not privatize all of the state parks. The private parks that I've been to, I really enjoyed, and I find them far less restrictive. Having a dog in a California state park makes you a third-class citizen, whereas the private parks seem more professional and more flexible, which you would expect from a business. I just wonder about privatizing all of them.
And, Bill, let me ask you, what private park have you visited?
There's a campground right on the Russian River. I forget the name of it. Down almost to the Coast Highway. Large park, really well run, very popular. And they're very pet friendly.
So besides the difference with and how you feel like you're treated with your dog, what other differences do you see between public and privately run parks?
Ultimately, not a lot. I just find the signs with 30 things you cannot do posted all over the parks disconcerting. It takes away from the experience for me, and you don't see that in the private parks. There's more of a, they tell you once and what the rules are, and then they assume you're an adult.
I get tired of the tens of thousands of dollars worth of signage telling me what not to do in state parks. And to me, that's an attitude that I've really gotten tired of.
Okay, so you believe that it gives you more freedom. Well, thank you for calling in, Bill. And let's go to Harry, who's concerned about the privatization of parks. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I think that judging by what I see here in San Francisco with Presidio, with the Arboretum, where they're putting in a new office, they want to put in a new office building to serve the San Francisco Botanical Garden Society, the commercialization of Union Square with a TV spewing commercials at night. It's unbelievable. A huge TV screen.
You know, I just saw that the other night, and I was kind of surprised. It's new, isn't it? Or fairly new. I haven't seen it before.
I heard it had been there. Someone told me it had been there for 2 years.
Oh.
But there's also Segway tours going on in Golden Gate Park. They had a zip line in the Embarcadero for a while. Food trucks are a horrible plague on Golden Gate Park. And I'm worried about this trend towards privatization, because that it means that rich people have control over what goes over there. Buildings start being named after rich people. All of a sudden, you know, you see food trucks in the parking lots of the state parks. Next, you see, like, parts of the state park charted out for weddings. Maybe some years down the line, they'll say, oh, we need a hotel to support this state park. Or we need, and these fees are all a form of regressive taxation, because a billionaire like Mark Buell pays the same $10 as somebody struggling on minimum wage. They're really unfair. And it's not that the taxpayers don't want to support the parks. It's that the money is misappropriated and frequently entered in huge boondoggles, such as the Central Subway.
Mm. Well, you brought up a lot of points, Harry. Let's take one more caller on this very issue, and then we'll get responses. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Rose. So, you know, for the panelists, and they've already touched on this a little bit, but I'd like for them to talk about it a little bit more. Really, you know, seeing the state park in terms of its future business structure, if you will, more as a commodity, and the situation that I ran into, my partner and I are going to be getting married in the next couple of years. We have a park near San Jose that we love. It's very important to us. And we inquired about having our commitment ceremony there. And there wasn't like a wedding packet. There wasn't fees. There wasn't really a lot of knowledge. And there was a lot of confusion with the staff people we talked to about how we would go about doing that. And I just thought that was interesting, because other places that we had looked into initially, anywhere from $3,000 all the way up to $7,000 for a space, and here we wanted to have it at one of our favorite parks, and there really wasn't that business sense of, yes, here's how we can do this, here's how we can bring money into the park while at the same time providing you a great space for your ceremony. So, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, with the way the budget things are, if this commodity approach could be used, but at the same time really keep the integrity of the parks as a beautiful, serene place.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on your upcoming commitment ceremony.
Thanks
for calling in. So a lot of things there. First off, why don't you all talk about, it's interesting that Bill wants the parks to be privatized. Harry's concerned that it'll lead to the commercialization of parks. Lisa, what are your thoughts on this?
This balance is really, really critical to us. And we, with our executive director and our own special events committee, have been looking at the fact there is a lot of pent-up desire to have weddings in parks. And yet, if you have, depending on the scale and size of the park, if you're having a wedding, you're using up all of the parking spaces for the people that would want to come to the park. So you really can't think in those. You have to think in all those terms. One of the things that I noted in our district was that the wedding package was a piece of paper that said no bird seed, no throwing of rose petals written in hand. Bring your own. You have to bring in your own toilets and folding chairs. This is not welcoming. Okay, a person who's wanting to have a sensitive private experience doesn't want to hear about toilets and folding chairs. They want to know how much would it cost to have my tender private experience. So in the midst of all of this transition, and even during this whole period of loss of staff, some of these things that could have been perhaps carefully managed have just sort of fallen apart. Now, when we are trying to get ready to do such things as weddings, we're trying to look at ways to do it so that we are not intruding upon people's private park experience. Some people want privacy, total silence. They want to, you know, they're the hikers. They can hike out. There won't be a wedding out there. But in the case of such things as zip lines and et cetera. There's just so many different types of activities that people love to do. Where is it written that any particular activity is better than another? It's, you know, look at the multi-use trails with horseback riding dogs, cyclists and hikers. These issues we've all been dealing with for a very long time, and there are times when you can actually bring all your constituents together and have a good result. So I want to say to the people that are concerned about these jumbotrons or strange namings or new hotels, I know that in our park this is not going to happen, but for those people who love to do unique things and would like to have a resource to do it, if it's possible, we want to consider it.
And Ruth, what are your thoughts on these concerns?
Well, I think, first of all, the word privatized is kind of a loaded one, and you have to be careful on what does that really mean. It means different things to different people. We actually use private concessions. We have over 200 of them in our parks. And in fact, we're even looking to see if the private sector wishes to operate some campgrounds. Now, generally speaking, if you look at the private sector, they're operating like 90,000 campsites in California. We only have 15,000 in the state park system. But at those campsites, they own just the footprint of the campground and then a little bit more real estate. Our state parks are 1.5 million acres of some of the most treasured, sensitive natural resources on the planet, and some of the most incredible historic and cultural resources. And stewarding those is very, very difficult to monetize. Moreover, there's a lot to run a park that people don't see. At the case here at Jack London, the wastewater and drinking water supply, all the water treatment is going to continue to be done by state parks. That is a very technical activity. It requires a lot of chemistry, and you have to have certified water people. Very expensive. We're actually going to continue doing that for the nonprofit. It's another example of the partnership where we didn't just, throw them, say, here, take care of this and do everything. We're also going to continue having our expertise on natural resources and cultural resource preservation, because, again, that kind of expertise is expensive. But how do you monetize the value of, say, a 2,000-year-old tree and stewarding it? Well, the only way to monetize a 2,000-year-old tree is to cut it down, and that is just simply not part of the way we look at things. I know we are very restrictive on dogs. It depends on which park. We have dogs on leash at some of our urban parks. We allow dogs in campgrounds. But in many places in our system, we are preserving the unique ecosystems of California. You know, we don't own everything in California. We don't want to. What we do own is the very unique ecosystems, and our charge is to preserve those for all the species that are there. And while even if your dog is on a leash, your dog has a scent as a predator, and it will affect the behavior within 100 feet of either side of where that dog walks, that the behavior of other of natural animals will actually be altered because your dog smells like a predator. It alters the behavior of the wildlife, and that's why we restrict dogs. It's not that we don't like dogs. It's that they actually change wildlife, and so we are pretty restrictive on those. And so I think, the key is using it in the right place at the right time. On weddings, we actually have a lot of weddings in our parks. A place called Addison House down in Malibu is booked, I think, about a year in advance. And we charge quite a bit because that's a good venue for weddings, and it doesn't affect a lot of the other public's access. And I do think we can do a lot more weddings. Empire Mine is another park. We have a lot of weddings. Some people get married at Hearst Castle. That's pretty expensive. But whenever you're doing weddings, you have to then be careful on how you site them so that you don't all of a sudden have a huge influx of people in one small space and then damage the resource.
Exactly.
So we haven't had a lot of staff, as Elisa mentioned, to be able to manage that. There's no question that more and more of our parks are looking to weddings to be a potential opportunity, but do understand also there's a fair amount of time involved in working with those who want to get married, and that time is also cost. And so are you actually making money at the end of the day? You need to have a venue which is used a lot, and then it becomes a really good, a moneymaker. Some of our parks up in Tahoe, mm-hmm. Weddings are a great moneymaker for us. So we definitely think weddings have, that's a great opportunity when it fits.
And Christopher, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. And Bill had been talking about his desire for parks to be more privatized. Again, Ruth is correct. It is a very loaded term. Harry has issues with the way the public access is used and maybe the sentiment of it. I think what I see when I go from park to park are so many different perspectives on what a park is and what it's to be used for. I find that that might be the most divisive discussion that I've had about parks. One of the things that detractors most often say to me about parks is, I don't go to that park, so I shouldn't have to pay for that park. I go to Mount Diablo. I should pay for Mount Diablo. For example, Golden Gate Park isn't a California state park, and the Presidio is, I think it's a federal national park. Yeah. And people don't understand always the difference between these parks, who pays for what, where the money comes from, city's paying for this, concessions are allowed here. And to some degree, maybe that doesn't matter to some people, and that's okay. But you wouldn't say the same thing about libraries. You wouldn't say, oh, I'm not going to pay for that library because I don't use it. Or the you have to think of parks as a whole as an asset for the state. And when you think about them that way, and you think about them in the sense that, you know, they're a great supplemental source of education for our schools, and a great place for recreation for people who can't afford it. And so even if you don't use a certain park, or you don't go to parks at all, or you see them for, if you want to use a private park, you want to use Golden Gate Park, whatever it is, we have to understand them as something bigger than just ourselves and our personal needs.
Well, and speaking of that, and sort of the common good, we're getting a lot of emails about this. And Ruth, the statement you made earlier about taxpayers, and Leslie writes in and says, I urge people to resist the temptation to facilitate the privatization of public institutions, schools, libraries, parks, by well-meaning charitable support. Public institutions are supposed to be paid for by the public through their taxes.
Yes.
The constant solicitation for private donations encourages the legislature to underfund these institutions. Let's stop this and raise taxes. We're getting a lot of emails like this.
This was a really serious concern we had from the very beginning. The idea that if you step in on a bake sale kind of mentality, then you're just going to be doing bake sale, bake sale, bake sale. You know, look at the public schools. And yet, here I'm standing in this place. It's absolutely incredible, a perfect replication of life in the early 20th century in thousands of acres, and I can't say, okay, then I'm not going to save it. That just doesn't fly. I couldn't do it. And I do not want to represent an option that forces all the state parks to close down. That isn't what we're trying to represent. We're trying to represent an opportunity to use your mind and heart and soul for a new model that hopefully would be applied in every way it can.
Well, and I just want to jump in and say, I think that there is a role for private funds and what Elise is doing. And I think there's a role for public funds. And one of the things that's key to tease out is that there's an element of the cost of a park that really is, at its core, a public good, and that I don't think the private sector will ever be able to fully monetize it. Right now, only about 10 of our parks net a profit. We charge in almost all our parks, but only 10 of them net a profit, and those are urban beaches where there's very little in the way of resources and just a ton of people using them. And so when you're talking about a park like what Elise is stepping up to do, there is this historic building, and if we preserve that building, it's now available for future generations to enjoy. That, by definition, is a public good. Doing things like keeping the wastewater clean, everybody benefits around there so there isn't a spill. That's a public good. The economic benefit of all those Europeans that she mentioned who are coming to that park, that is a huge boon to the entire California economy. We estimate that we're bringing in about $6 billion into the California economy just through our state parks alone. And when you look at what the Department of Commerce or the Tourism Commission does, when they're advertising California and the tourism industry to bring people to California, about two-thirds of their imagery are state parks. Mm-hmm. This is what defines California. I remember talking to a fellow from Italy who was a visiting scholar, and we were talking about the closures, and he said, you know, we Europeans think of America and we think of California. We think of your landscapes. That is what defines your country to us. And you think of my country, you don't think of our parks, you think of Italy, you think of our cathedrals. So you closing your parks is like us closing our cathedrals. Our image to the world is our landscape, and we were the first ones to ever create the idea of public lands for all people.
And Ruth, let me ask you this. We have another email from Taylor who says, the downside of the proposals to have to sell parks to private groups or to have nonprofits take over the responsibility for management is that this will become the model for dismantling the state park system completely and result in the the removal of all state funding for parks. He says it's incredibly frustrating to hear today's dedicated guest discuss the responses to these unconscionable budget cuts as though they're inevitable and irreversible. There needs to be an honest discussion of the broken political process that allows the dismantling of the public resources that are fundamental to maintaining a healthy California economy. So do you think this will result in the model, the dismantling of the state park system completely?
I don't think Elisa's group stepping up is going to result in dismantling. I think what her group is doing is helping us maximize the amount of private funds and entrepreneurial funds to help steward these resources, but it doesn't absolve us from the core public good element. The ones I worry more about are the ones where there isn't a partner yet.
Yes.
And we have probably a dozen parks that I really lose sleep over, because if we can't find a partner for them, then what happens? What does it really mean to not have any infusion of human energy into stewarding these amazing treasures? And just because people haven't gone out to see them doesn't mean that they didn't have a reason to save them in the first place. So I do think that this triggers a much larger conversation, but it's a conversation the governor's having with the state of California right now. Overall, I mean, this is not unique to my department. You're looking at huge cuts at the UCs,
right? Because
schools, everywhere else.
If that tax initiative doesn't pass in November, the UCs will not admit students next year, and students right now are on hunger strike because of their tuition increases.
Right.
So, and I bring this up just because we're getting slammed with emails from people saying, this is just not acceptable. We need to have the funding for these parks.
But where were they when we were going to have Prop 21?
And that lost by how much?
Well, in our county, it passed.
Right.
And now we have, I think, 7 parks that are closing in our county.
Yeah, it's important. This was the proposition that would have funded the state parks.
Yes, but one of the issues about that.
The vehicle
registration.
Right.
And in the Central Valley, a lot of people would have had to pay a lot of money, especially imagine now for gas, just to get to the nearest state park would have cost them nearly $100. Okay, so you have to understand that in the areas where there's not very many parks, the idea of paying for them was just not comfortable and wasn't acceptable. And, you know, I was at the legislature when they were doing hearings about it, and I understand that. So, yeah, I agree, we have to have a huge conversation, and we need a groundswell of public sentiment and public outcry. You know, public outcry is a very big tool, and this is why I'm happy to be here today. And I thank you.
Yeah, and if anyone is that's listening isn't clear, I absolutely believe that the political process that got us to this point is broken. But I'm not in favor of boiling the ocean to try and solve some of these problems. I feel that there are specific problems that we can fix. And we can fix them in certain ways. And you can't just close down a park and expect it to open a couple years later and be in the same condition.
Yes.
It will be forever damaged. And so we have to step in and do these things. I'm happy to discuss the problems of California government, ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, where to make a difference there. I know where to make a difference here. I can put up a Facebook page. So can everybody listening right now. I can go and I can document people who are taking care of parks. I can put those on YouTube. I can tell people their stories. I can do what I can to help raise money for each of these parks. I can I can share what these people are talking about. And so can everybody else that's out there. If you don't think you can make a difference, think again. And if you think that parks are ancillary, if you think that they shouldn't matter, that we should wait around for people to find ways to fund them through the general budget, think about what we're going to lose when we let these parks fall by the wayside and students of the next generation don't understand what conservation means because we haven't shown them.
What about the incredible natural resources that we're relying on these to provide? We have watershed, biodiversity and all these other aspects that are really part of the state park system. It's not just that somebody can go and run on a trail or look at something that is old.
And we have a caller from Boulder Creek who wants you to give him an update on Andrew Malera State Park and Armstrong Redwoods. Ruth, can you give us an update on those?
Andrew Malero, I don't think is on the
list. Actually, no, I don't even see that
on
this list.
It's not on the list.
That's not on
no.
the list. left.
What about Armstrong Redwoods? Is not on the list either.
Austin Creek.
But Austin Creek is a 60 campground camp that has 5,000 acres surrounding it. It's going to be. It's in the process of getting a special agreement drafted with a between the district, California State Parks, and stewards of the coast and redwoods. And that's a really beautiful combination approach that's based on a fabulous relationship that that particular association has with the district. So that's going to work out.
So at this point, Ruth, you said we have 56 parks. 16 for sure have been issued a reprieve, and the others are either requesting proposals or in negotiations.
Yeah, we have about 19 that were in negotiations, and then another 21, which are parks that have campgrounds on them, and we've put out requests for proposal to nonprofits, private sector, to see if there are entities that would want to come and run the campground. Again, I want to emphasize, we are not privatizing these entire parks. What we're doing is saying, is there a concessionaire who would be willing to operate the campground? And then we would continue having, as we are in all of the cases, we are maintaining our trustee role as stewards of these parks. So in no cases are we somehow turning them over, but I do think it's really important to echo what Chris said, which is now is the time for people to step up. There is another $3 billion hole in the state budget that they're finding just right now. I mean, it is not realistic to think that this $22 million is going to come back. We have a reality that we're dealing with now. The governor has an enormous challenge to try to bring budgets into balance, and I don't fault him at all for the decisions that he's made or the legislature, what they've made in this crisis. So the key is, how are we going to get through this? But the larger question is going to be, at the end of the day, how do we maximize the amount of private funds that, you know, that we can bring in, but recognizing at the core there is a public good that you will never be able to fully monetize from the private
sector. So there is a possibility that about 20 parks might be closed in July.
Yeah, definitely. And we're going to keep working with folks, even if we don't have an agreement by July 1st. We're not going to be just dropping the axe. We'll be saying we'll continue to talk to people as much as possible. There will be a lag on as we move staff around, and so in some cases, if there are still staff that haven't yet been relocated and they're still at that park,
just 10 seconds, Elisa, what can people do to keep these parks open?
Well, first of all, you need to go to your parks. That's your number one job, okay?
And pay.
Yeah, and pay. When you go and you see a way to pay, pay.
All right, well, we'll definitely do another show in the coming months to get more updates. Ruth Coleman, Director of California State Parks, Elisa Stancil, with Valley of the Moon Natural History Association. They're taking on operations at Jack London. And Christopher Ward, Executive Director of Folk for Parks. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation with Rory O'Connor, journalist and author of the new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. We'll also discuss coverage of the Arab Spring with independent journalist Reese Ehrlich, who's just back from Tunisia. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What grabbed your attention this week? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.